Can I ask you a question, Ted?
Shoot. Not you.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week, we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Thanks for listening to Still Queer as Folk. If you take a minute to click the subscribe button right now, you'll never miss the sound of my voice and Matt's voice as you fall asleep every Wednesday night at midnight.
And make sure you like us on Facebook. We're at Still Queer as Folk. And also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Still Queer AF.
This episode is called Bowling for Equality. It's number 19 in season 2 of Queer as Folk. Second to the last episode this season.
We're almost done with season 2.
Oh, so sad, though.
This first aired in the U.S. on June 9th, 2002.
It was directed by Michael DiCarlo. He directed 11 episodes of the show, and this is his 8th.
Bowling for Equality was written by executive producers Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman, and the teleplay was written by Ephraim Seeger and Michael McLennan.
You know, I think the final episode of this season was only written by Cohen and Lipman. I think they did the teleplay, too, so that should be interesting next week.
Well, they wanted to take over.
Here's a recap of Bowling for Equality from Queer as Folk, the book.
Lita wants to continue her affair with Melanie and Lindsay, and the girls have trouble letting her down gently.
The girls.
Girls.
That's like so 2002-ish. Girls. Women. Ted hits a dry spell when porn no longer affects him, until new distractions arrive when he realizes he has feelings for Emmett.
Wait, what?
Oh, sorry, that's Horvath.
Horvath.
For a bath.
Listeners, as I've tried to follow the script, Horvath apparently autocorrected to for a bath.
We script the intro here and sort of ad-lib it as we go, but that's my fault. So let's try that again.
Debbie challenges Horvath and his friends to a gay versus straight bowling match and manages to lose gracefully as she grows distant from the cop.
The cop.
Horvath.
Michael sees Justin with Ethan and tells Brian.
It isn't so much tell Brian as really lead him to that conclusion.
I don't know why, but I thought it was great seeing Justin and Ethan in bed together.
You know, you make love like you play your violin.
More than accompanist in front of a cherry mafia. On a street corner for cash.
Like you're in a trance. Your eyes closed.
And you're my instrument. First I tune you, and then I stroke you with my bow. I'm gonna make beautiful sounds pour out of you.
This is what's missing.
I don't know what it was. I loved it.
It's because there is
love.
Incredible sexual chemistry. Like, what's missing right now between Brian and Justin is what's on fire with Justin and Ethan. Like, they just have this natural fire between the two of them that makes it look sexy. Like I said, like I mentioned last week, where I felt, you know, the sex scene between Brian and Justin felt very clinical, very cold. Here, it's just, it is hot.
Do you think that the sex had cooled off between Justin and Brian? I mean, they were hot scenes, but there's that one that you remember where Justin was sort of being raped by Brian.
He very much acquiesced to the demand of, okay, yeah, you can go ahead and enter me. But that's about it. There was no passion behind it.
Yeah.
Here, there is clearly passion. Two artists going at it like that.
They were really just looking so lusty with each other.
Yes.
Loved it. Ethan gives Justin this idol of waking up together. And Randy Harrison really acted that moment so well. We see his face that he's hearing Ethan's words and he's wanting it, but then he has no real choice but to just kind of silently leave without a word. He just turns around and he's out the door. It's like, okay, that's sort of bad form with this trick that you're all lusty with, that you're, you know, really into. It's like, say goodbye. Go give him a kiss.
Well, first of all, that's sort of against the rules, remember?
Oh, what? They cross that line.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. Yes, those rules are long gone. Would you go so far as to just say that Ethan is a trick?
Oh, no. Well, that's a good question. I guess the way that it was shot in this intro, we are led to believe that it's way more than just a trick. I think they must have started out as, let's just mess around. I don't know.
And I
that's
feel,
a good question.
That's the thing. I feel that the episodes preceding this to allow the development of those kinds of, well, let's just call them their feelings. There is clearly something more than just physical attraction happening, that it's hard for me to say that this may just be a one trick kind of deal.
Yeah, you're right. That's something that we've talked about in the past, is a lot of gay relationships start out with fucking.
And I mean, Brian and Justin started with fucking.
And this one didn't. This one started out with that emotional attraction. I think that's called demisexual, where you're just not attracted to people that, unless you have this emotional connection with them. That's me.
Aww.
I sort of felt bad for Brian when Justin got back from his hookup, though, because Brian, it seemed like he sensed something was going on with Justin. He sensed and scented.
Yes.
Like, I can smell it.
He can smell the stank.
Then that shower scene that they had. Ooh.
Yeah. So
I got a note about this one, too. I want to hear yours first.
Well, first of all, I was impressed that he brought a condom in the shower. I feel like all the times that we've seen them have sex in the shower, that's never, I guess it's always just been implied. This is the first time we've actually seen it.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of times in the show where it's like the kind of the porno magic condom.
Yes, it just so happens to be there.
Yeah, it's all of a sudden it's, oh, okay. But here it was like a big deal where he's got the condom. He opens it with his teeth.
Again, at some point, you would have thought someone would have had that conversations with the show, saying like, we get it, it's sexy, but that means that people are going to mimic this. And thus, things aren't going to work like they should.
Mm-hmm. I have really sharp teeth. That could could cause a problem.
Do you bite hard?
I used to. And then I found out that a lot of people really don't like that. And so even when invited, it's like, oh, not that hard. It's like, all right. Mm. So I think I've converted into a nibbler.
Oh, there you go. Now, for me, even in this shower scene, I felt like the sex still didn't feel erotic like it did earlier in the series. It didn't feel legitimately sexy. It still felt like there was a clear distance.
Well, there's that moment where Justin turned around and paused and looks in Brian's eyes and says,
Brian,
what do you think he was going to say there? Was he going to tell the truth? Or was he going to say, I want more romance?
You almost think it's going to be like, Brian, we need to talk.
Right.
Like the action was going to stop.
Take that condom off.
But you let him continue.
Because for me, obviously, it seemed like he was about to tell him about Ethan. But then I thought, this is way too soon to be looping in Brian on, like, I've seen somebody that I want to see again. Because this is like their first date. So then I crossed that off. Then I thought maybe Justin's just angling for a more romantic type of relationship. So I don't know. It was a nice pause, though, in the shower. And I was like, oh, he's going to do it. He's going to do it. He's going to tell him.
And then it didn't happen. Yeah. And instead he sort of, it's like, no, it's not the right time.
Nice writing. Nice cinematography there. And great score. This was another song by Placebo. Remember a couple episodes ago, I talked about Brian Mulko. Mm-hmm. The song was actually called Without You, I'm Nothing.
Little on the nose.
Yeah, great music cue. If you listen closely to that song, you can hear David Bowie doing the duet with Brian Mulko. Strange infatuation seems to grace the evening tide. I'll take it by your side. And that's actually included in the airing copy of this episode.
Thank goodness.
Do you think that Justin got topped by both Brian and Ethan within a couple hours?
Yes.
Really? You don't think Justin was topping Ethan? Maybe they flipped.
Maybe there's some flipping happening, because we all know that Justin is very much averse.
Oh, well, I wouldn't say very much. He occasionally tops strangers.
I think that tells me that he is versatile.
Okay.
So I'm going to run with that.
Is that very verse? We'll go with acceptably verse.
Yes. It's sort of like that whole agree, somewhat disagree, agree, strongly agree. He's at that neutral. How about there?
It's like an NPS score.
Yes. But yeah, I would like to think that there's probably some flipping happening because I think that's the kind of chemistry that they give off to each other. They want to help each other in their pleasures.
Michael and Justin decided, let's go out and tack some posters up to light poles around Pittsburgh. And of course, there's violin music on the street as Michael and Justin are walking along.
It calls to him.
How stupid was it for Justin to send Michael merely across the street so that he could go stick his tongue in Ethan's mouth? Don't send him across the street. Send him like around the corner.
Like a far enough distance.
Yeah.
But right now it's that passion that is sort of making Justin make not great decisions. Like, excuse me, while I deep tongue this guy.
Like in full view of you.
Like, wow. But again, even that kiss was like super passionate. I'm like, you know, it's like the Pittsburgh winter. Good on you, I guess, for being able to make out like that.
Do you think that Michael is aware of the rules that Brian and Justin have? He's aware of the no kissing rule?
I wrote that he is well aware that there is an arrangement. Now, granted, he probably doesn't understand the extent of that arrangement, but I would assume because Michael has been cognizant that both have been fucking people other than each other. I mean,
yeah,
we all know this. To your point is that I think it's the extent in which their arrangement that Michael has the question. And then I want to know if it's really Michael's place to quote unquote expose Justin.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't know that arrangement.
That's what the whole A story is about here is Justin's clandestine relationship. I don't know why, but I laughed out loud when Ethan said,
"Hey, you want to go get a latte?"
I don't know what it was about that line.
I think it's probably the latte. It's probably the fact that it's a latte. It's the soul patch. I'm putting a lot on that soul patch because Ethan's, to me, almost perfect. It's that soul patch that just grates me.
Oh, it was 2002, so.
I feel like that's not an excuse. I know Ty Pennington was a thing, but no soul patch for me.
Well, that soul patch was pressed up against Justin's chin, and boy, that kiss was hot on the street.
That heat is there.
But again, duh, Michael's across the street.
He's literally, I love that they kiss and as they break apart, there's Michael beautifully framed.
Yeah, I love that stink eye that Michael shot across the street.
Oh, man.
That was great.
Now, do you think that the reason why there is so much passion and heat between Justin and Ethan is that because it's just new for Justin?
No, like, I think he's really got the emotional connection there with the fiddle player because the fiddle player is the fiddle player, Ethan.
He's a violinist.
He's saying all the right things to Justin. It's almost like he got the Justin manual and he's going down the list, checking all the boxes, saying all the right things. If you think about it that way, it's almost like a purpose-built character for anti-Brian.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they are definitely like opposite ends of the spectrum. And because Justin has spent so much time on the Brian end, he is gravitating towards the almost like balance himself out again.
In this scene, I was like a little more interested in what Michael was doing because when he gets sight of that kiss going on, it's almost like we could see the wheels turning in his head. And it was like back to Michael 1.0.
It was very much like, I got him.
Yeah. Because remember, he always wanted to get Justin away from Brian and he was sending him like out of the gayborhood and things like that. And it was kind of interesting to see a flashback because that was season one. After Justin got bashed at the end of season one, beginning of season two, Michael was kind of an okay guy towards Justin. Now it was like, just as you said, I got him.
Yes, he finally has what he needs to be rid of Justin forever.
And it made me think that even more when later they're at the bowling alley. Michael had this terrifying look on his face.
Brian already is perfect.
Why do you think so?
And I remember this look. It was from season one when he says,
I'm going to blow up a bridge.
Remember it was like heavy on light days and light on heavy days? He did the same like crazy Chucky look. Was like, I was just like, oh, that's so good.
And loved Michael's it. Already kind of a mess with the whole Ben thing finally being out of the hospital. That it's like, Michael, just let Brian and Justin work this out. You don't have to involve yourself.
MYOB.
Seriously.
There is a, speaking of Ben, there's a great scene of Michael and Ben in bed, especially when Ben's taking his pants off. Yeah, I knew you were going to get excited.
Yes. That overhead shot of them having like probably the most basic discussions of like Michael trying to figure out what should he do, all the while Ben is like moving the bed sheets and he's just going down on him. And I'm like,
Ben was hard. He was hard and ready to go. There's this moment, the to tell Brian or not moment is what I called it.
Okay. Does he know that you saw him?
I was across the street. So do I tell Brian or not?
Absolutely not.
What, rule number two of gay etiquette? Never tell your best friend that his boyfriend is cheating on him?
If you're wrong, he will be furious.
And if I'm right?
He'll be even furiouser.
Furiouser. A professor would not make up a word.
I think maybe
furiouser.
He was probably just trying to get down to Michael's level.
More furious would have been better. Furiouser. But what would you do in this, Matt, if you were Michael and you saw this going on? You saw your best friend's boyfriend making out with a violinist on a street in the winter in Pittsburgh.
I'm of the opinion that I wouldn't
really
say anything based on at least the knowledge of they clearly have an arrangement and it's not my place to jump on that because I don't know every single rule.
Okay. I didn't think of that. I didn't think about a pre-existing arrangement that I had not been briefed on at that time.
Right. Because I feel like now we are a lot more open about discussing such things that I would be okay knowing that, oh, well, good on him. Look at him get that. I'd be a little jealous, but you know, I would be like, woo, look at that. And then I would know that if I were to say, bring it up, saying, who the hell was that? And then that like sparks something, that would be
furiouser.
That would be a furiouser.
Furiouser you know, moment.
It's all about knowing when to mind your business, like you said, MYOB.
I think if I saw it, I would absolutely tell my best friend. Bros over hoes, right?
Now,
no.
Well, I mean, but...
But I would do it in a way that would make sure that my best friend understands that I don't know all the facts. I wouldn't come out and say, you know what I saw? It was this, it was that.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, it was
You would take the more Michael approach and when he's talking to Brian of Babylon where he says, you know, how much do you really know?
No,
like, does that not bother you?
No, I would be a little more forthright. I would say something along the lines of, Matt, I saw Anthony making out with somebody on the corner. I don't know what's going on. I know that you're into him. That's all I know. Just wanted you to know. I wouldn't have done like the Michael Sinister thing.
He clearly tips it in that more...
Like twist your mustache type of look.
He almost said it with a sneer.
Yeah, it wasn't like Michael was really trying to protect Brian. It was more like he was trying to evict Justin.
Yeah, he wanted to expose Justin, and it was very strange.
And I would approach this as I just want to protect my best friend. So I think I would absolutely tell my best friend.
Okay.
I would expect my friends to tell me too. It's like I have people everywhere. You are being watched.
No, yeah, and that's because like I'm of someone who. Something like open relationships and special arrangements are just something that I don't think I could do. And people know that about me. So
I didn't know that about you.
Yeah. Me personally is just something at least that right now, I don't think I could do. Could that change? Possibly. If I am with the right person and trust the right person, you know, it's possible. But at this point in time, not for me.
I've always said that I would never do that either. But then I think about different possible outcomes and different people. And I'm like, if it meant like seeing this guy like 90% of the time, I could probably get away with, not get away, but be okay with 10% going to somebody else.
Eh?
I wouldn't like that though.
No.
I don't like OPP. So Michael just has to interrogate Brian at Babylon. And that's the part that I didn't really relate to. Again, he was trying to evict Justin, not protect his friend. And Brian knew it right away. Brian knew exactly what was going on. This scene was shot so well, though.
Yes, I actually loved this whole sequence. And I think because at first, Brian has an excellent point. Justin is 19. Brian is the only person he's really, quote unquote, dated.
Yeah, true.
Let him have his fun. And I like that Brian is like, I don't care. I don't need to have that. I don't need to have what you and Ben have. It doesn't bug me because, like, we are both fucking whoever we want to. I was that way at that age. He needs to go and have his fun. That's not a problem.
What if there was someone else, someone that he was seeing that you didn't know about?
What if there was?
You'd be okay with that, too?
He doesn't owe me anything.
What about the truth?
There was something about what Brian was saying to Michael, though, that is a different dimension, which is it's possible that Brian was saying, yeah, I know what's going on. Yeah, it bothers me. There's no way in hell I'm going to let Michael know that. I have to be...
Oh, he's
I have
putting to maintain, on a front of sorts.
Yeah, I have okay. to maintain my superhero status with Michael. I can't let my guard down and be vulnerable. You see it at the end, after the scene is wrapping up, Brian has this look of, huh.
Absolutely, because there is this...
Let's back up.
So the editing of this scene...
Oh, so good.
...is so fantastic because we have... Brian and Michael at Babylon. Michael intros the conversation with, where's Justin?
Yeah. And what do you think he's doing? Don't you wonder?
He might as well be like, wink, wink, nudging. Yeah.
I know something you don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm like, he's like, he's playing the $10,000 pyramid with him. He's trying to give him the clues to get to the point of Justin may be emotionally cheating on you, not just mm-hmm. fucking some dude, but like, falling for someone. They intercut this with Justin in bed with Ethan having incredibly intimate, like they're like taking each other in kind of
He was
sex.
Drawing him.
Oh my God.
Let me draw you like a French girl.
while he was playing his violin. Yeah, like that may have been the most erotic thing that I have seen in this series.
Remember when I told you about the boy that woke me up playing the guitar? It was just like that.
Soaked.
Soak the sheets.
So they're intercutting this conversation at Babylon with the classical music, and Michael just continuing to try and fill the seed of doubt in Brian. Mm-hmm. And Brian continues to ward it off, and he's deflecting it and he's dodging it. And then to end the scene, which I thought this was so brilliant, to just cut all the music out. We don't even hear the Babylon music. We don't hear the violin. And to cut to Brian, clearly now questioning what he thinks he knows, was just fantastic.
Yeah, I love it when there's a disconnect between the audio and the visual cuts. So Podeswa has the audio carrying through between the two scenes and then swapping, and then the visual swap, and then there's this emptiness. It was very, very stylish, very nicely done. Later at Woody's, which I didn't like this scene at all, but Michael can't resist digging into Brian again.
It's too bad Justin couldn't be here tonight.
Dude. It's like...
Make like Elsa and let it go.
Yeah, and I'd like to think that Brian has enough superpowers that he was seen through this whole thing and just being like, Michael, I see you for what you are and I see what you're doing. It's like, just knock it off.
He's being petty and obnoxious. Let me live my life.
Yeah. Another thing that I thought was strange about this story arc is that Ben was unusually okay with Michael having told Brian.
It's actually right. I told him, didn't I?
Oh, no.
He didn't seem to care.
And he's just like matter of fact about it. I just thought that he would have been a little more like, dude, I can't believe you told him. I think that's a really tough skill to learn in a relationship where you need to let the other person sleep in their own bed, metaphorically.
Right.
Like if they're mm-hmm. going to make these choices, they have to own them and live with them versus trying to talk them out of it, trying to help, in quotes, help them through it or advise them to do something different. You have to be okay with the notion that your boyfriend, partner, girlfriend will be doing something different that may not be what you really want them to do.
It's like knowing that, okay, that's a decision you're going to make. Be ready to lie in that bed.
And by the way, I'll be there with you for it, but
it's going to get rough.
And I'm going to try very hard not to say, I told you so.
Oh, but it feels so good.
So Justin comes back to the loft on cloud nine, humming violin music. And then this is a really interesting moment in the show where it almost turned into like The Walking Dead, where Brian comes like lurking out of the shadows.
Yeah, yes, with all that top light creates such shadows.
I was like, wow.
Because Brian has been drinking.
Justin has been fucking.
And he wants to go and take a shower.
Why wouldn't Justin just wash the sex off of him at Ethan's place before going home?
I mean, compared to
you can't Ethan's go home with all that goop on you.
All that what on you, Patrick? Did you say goop? Goop?
Yeah, goop.
Interesting. Choice of words. Part of me wonders if Ethan even has running water in his place.
Oh, that's a good point. You might be onto something there. He might be showering at the school for all we know.
Oh, he's totally using the locker rooms.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Justin wants to go and take a shower to wash the stank off. And Brian doesn't let him, and he wants to, and like they try to ignite something.
Yeah,
the
way I wrote this down was Brian does his best to summon all of his superpowers to overwhelm Justin.
And then he takes like deep whiffs.
Well, first, man, Justin is sure getting laid a lot, isn't he? Everybody's fucking him. That boy must be like loose at this point.
Just flaps in the wind at this point.
He's getting it twice a day from two different people.
Yep.
It's like, dude.
Right now, his asshole sounds like this.
So Brian gets Justin all worked up and then bam, turns him down. One thing that I liked about that scene was this great shot by DiCarlo of Brian and Justin on the floor, but it was turned vertically.
Yes.
I don't know what it was about that, or I don't know the film school meaning behind it, but I loved it. I don't know why.
It's a very cool image. It was a very cool image.
Very stylish. Very neat. We'll be right back.
Are you following us on Twitter? Instagram? Check us out at StillQueerAF.
This is Still Queer Spoken. There's more to come.
So this episode begins with Ted being very much all business with his porn studio.
I noticed something about Ted's porn studio here. Did you notice that they are doing a little bit more than jerk-off videos now in that porn company?
The title of the website was all in an effort to allow people to surf porn at work without getting caught. That was the original conceit.
It used to be a jack-off site. Now it's like hardcore fucking.
Okay, so yeah, let's talk about this studio, because I don't understand how he is able to have multiple scenes being filmed all at once.
With no cameraman.
It's just, so we see that in like one camera, there's a three-way happening with like a hotel scene because there's a bellboy getting spit roasted. We then have like a sort of Little Mermaid Under the Sea action happening. Am I to assume that if he's able to film all of these scenes all at once and have all of these models all fucking at the exact same time, that there's no sound on any of these live feeds?
Yeah, that's right, because he's giving them the cues like, oh, shoot. Oh, no, not you.
Not you.
Yeah, sorry, Ted.
I'm going to make that my ringtone. I thought that was great.
Can I ask you a question, Ted?
Shoot. Not you.
Sorry, Ted.
You.
How do you get any work done with all these hot, horny guys surrounding you?
Because if there is sound that's coming through the website, it would just be a cacophony of noise.
Oh, yeah.
There's no way that you could have focused any one of those scenes. To me, it's all just streaming images with no sound whatsoever. That's the only way this can make sense to me.
Well, I wonder if this is really just like an archetype where we need to see all aspects of porn in order to understand that Ted has become immune to it. So we need to see the extreme as civilians in order to say that the person that sees it every day, Ted, has become immune.
Let's get into this. So even though Ted had in his schedule Rimorama and Dildo Days, spelled D-A-Z-E.
Did you write those down?
Of course I did. I thought they were hilarious. So he had these in his schedule because this is his job. He is business. And I don't see a problem with that. But after he has released the models for the day in full costume.
Yeah, they just walk out on the street.
Like, no. You're going to change because that shit is expensive. They could hawk that shit really easily. No way. Yeah,
he doesn't have like a locker room or...
He needs a wardrobe supervisor. You would think he could afford that. I mean, he has that assistant who, where did he come from?
Eddie. The thing that I didn't like about Eddie is that he calls Ted Mr. Schmidt. Just like Ted used to call his boss, Wartschafter. Yeah. I think that's weird in this series. It's uniquely formal at work. And I almost think that the writers have tried to draw that line so that when you're in work, your boss is Mr. Ryder, Vance.
To let you know that they are at work.
Exactly. When's the last time that you called somebody at work Mr. or Mrs. or Ms.?
Oh, I never do that.
Yeah, exactly. It just doesn't happen. So I thought that was curious writing there, the way that that comes into play.
It's a little simplistic.
Yeah. Anyway, I can see that Ted would become desensitized to porn. Anything that you're doing all day, every day, it seems like it'd eventually become uninteresting.
Well, I think it's more that I get Ted's position and that it's a business and he has to remain professional.
Yeah, but still, it's like all that going on, you wouldn't at least like get a little chubby?
I mean... He's living his dream. So maybe, I mean, I'm sure he still loves what he does. He says that to the guys before they leave that like he's living the dream. This is what he's like. He's his own boss. He's working in clearly something he loves. I mean,
well,
I
remember when he had to take Viagra for that dude that was coming over?
That's true.
Kind of a precursor to the I've become desensitized to porn. Hey, I know. I like Emmett.
Well, from the beginning, I always took it as I think this is a business versus pleasure thing. He is able to separate it because if he just then became a sex hound and fucked every model that walked in, then that would be a problem.
What bar was it that Brian met up with Ted in? It looked kind
of like...
Was that
Woody's?
Well, they called it Woody's, but it looked like a garage. It was not Woody. It was not the Woody's. This was like a soundstage back
that was
into like the back of the diner with just some posters on the wall and some dudes.
I just totally thought it was Woody's. I didn't think anything else
totally
of it.
Different. It was really weird. Apparently there's table service there because Ted just calls out his drink order.
Hey, Brian, wait. Come have a drink on me. Couple of doers.
Oh, we're serious tonight.
So
just
yeah, I just
Garcon.
Thought it was I just thought it was weird. Like, where are they? Most of the sets and most of the scenes are really well known. We really only get different scenes when they do exteriors. This was a unique interior that we hadn't seen before.
Totally.
We
were
talking
always...
about getting hard on a porn set to like, do you think this was a different scene in the bar?
What jumps we make on this show.
Yeah. So Ted's immune to porn. I was liking those interplays between Brian and Ted. First, we had the you don't have a boyfriend because you don't want one back and forth between Brian and Ted. Now we have another back and forth between Brian and Ted. And it got me thinking that, man, I wish there was a lot more between these two characters because they are complete opposites. Brian is like alpha male. Ted is the former, like, I don't know what you call a non-alpha male, like a beta pup.
Sub.
Yeah.
Well, and but
who's on the uptick of becoming a man of means? Because of his porn empire. So I like that he had this fantasy of, I want to be Brian. I thought that was great.
Yeah, so let's break down this fantasy. So
very well directed.
So we see the fantasy play out to the... And
we
I
see
actually,
two versions of the
yes,
fantasy.
Yes, and in this first version, we basically see the ideal version.
Mm-hmm.
Ted takes a bottle of water, dumps it on his head... Like Brian does.
Oh, yeah. When the scene first starts, you think it's Brian because you see his cowrie shell bracelet, black pants. And then all of a sudden you start to see Ted's torso and you're like, that's not Brian.
Yes, because Brian is not hairy like that.
Right.
And Ted totally does the moves, gets on the bed with the blue light and three super hunky men,
mm-hmm.
and they just go at it.
Get it.
And I was like, whoa, look at you, Ted. You go. Good for you.
And then I liked the opposite.
What actually happened, which I thought was hilarious.
He chokes on the water, spits it out. It's like he's being waterboarded.
And then gets in the bed where the three guys are going at it, and he's just trying to maneuver his way in.
I wrote down, Ted trying to climb into the orgy was hilarious because he was just like climbing all over them. Like,
yeah, and hey, he was just slipping like because of oblivious. The lube, and he just like, yeah. he could not get an entry point to join in the action. It was just, and I loved the awkwardness of it because Lord knows, I feel like we have all had that moment of, oh, I can't believe it's finally going to happen, or oh, I've always wanted to, and then it just sort of kind of
gets gross.
It doesn't work. Like the mechanics of trying to have sex with somebody is just like, you know, this is just not happening.
I don't know about that problem.
Oh, okay. Listeners, if you ever make it with Patrick,
yeah,
it will be perfect.
It usually is. There's usually violin music.
Oh my God.
I told you about the time I hired the violinist to play over my dinner.
And he didn't leave.
That's right. He had to be kicked out.
Yep.
So there was something here that was very telling. That's the moment that Ted lifted an eyebrow towards Emmett.
And I loved this quiet scene where it's two friends trying to maneuver the complicated life that they lead. And it's Emmett just trying to It's Emmett trying to lift up Ted. You know, he gives him like a little bit of a makeover, and you know, he just cheers him up. And it's little scenes like that that I really love in this series.
You know something, Ted Schmidt?
What?
I love you.
And then Ted is like,
dive on it.
Huh. Head tilt.
So that was just a little bit of a runner of what we're going to see soon with Ted and Emmett. This teed it up very quickly, I might add. It's almost like another one of those situations where I'd rather see this play out over many more episodes. But okay, this will work. Let's talk about Melanie and Lindsay and Lita.
Yes.
Let me give you my first note here.
Okay, go ahead.
Did you think it was like super creepy how Lita just kind of skulked into Melanie and Lindsay hooking up?
Yes. It's my first note too. My first note was, so they have sex with the door wide open.
And then she joined in.
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, wait
dive
a minute. But then based on the conversation, so yes, they're like, they were clearly like scissoring each other. You know, they were having their sex. They were having sex.
I just got it out of the corner of my eye. You like trying to find that word. Like they were just scissoring.
Yeah. You know, doing what they do and apparently really enjoying it. And they were really happy that the threesome happened because it reignited the flame for them and got them excited about each other again. And that's what they needed. And then Lita just walked in. And it wasn't until the conversation the next day when they're like, how do we deal with this? Because that can't happen again. The door was like, I guess, unlocked. And Lita felt that she hurt because she heard them going at it, like, oh, time for me to go dive in too. Opened the door and said, hi, I'm here. Tag me in. That made it even creepier.
Hey, girls. Lita? I heard the floorboards squeaking overhead and...
our next renovation?
Figured, since you're up, why don't we have a little slumber party? Just us girls.
Oh, gosh, there's Gus.
I better go see what's wrong.
It's one thing to, like, walk by it because then shame on Mel and Lindsay. But to say that... oh, I hear them having sex. I'm going to go up and open the door and say,
and join.
Room for one more. Ugh, weird.
Well, okay. I've actually had this happen to me more than once.
Okay.
Okay, so my family has a summer house not far away from Chicago. For quite a while, about every weekend in the summer, a group of us would go up together. We'd all drive up together. And without fail, like the more slutty members of the team, the crew, The team. I got a really big team. We need some really big rings.
Oh.
That's a Drake song. You might know him as Jimmy from Degrassi.
Oh, we'll need to link the video that he just dropped.
Oh, yeah.
To all of our Drake fans because it was amazing.
So anyway, we would drive up. And then the more slutty members of the team, the crew, my entourage. It wasn't
Posse?
Really,
is that,
wasn't
is,
really my entourage. No, okay. We were kind of mutual entourage. They would always get these locals to come over and they would like to hang out with us. And, you know, we go swimming in the middle of the night, drink a lot, play tennis during the day, things like that. More times than not, like I might be hooking up with somebody and then somebody else in the team like joins. Like exactly the way that Lita did. So when this scene happened, I was like, oh my God. I thought this That's was me. Just gay men, but it's really lesbians. Lesbians do that too. It was fun though. It was really great. Eventually I like disowned and dismissed the entire entourage.
Oh.
They started to get a little like, I guess, more into cocaine and drugs than... You were like taking an Instagram video of me right there. And as soon as I said cocaine, you went, oh, and put the phone down.
I almost went Instagram live. So I'm glad I didn't.
We do have an explicit rating only on Apple Podcasts.
Right.
Not on Instagram. So anyway, there was something in the scene that I bumped on, which is we see Gus.
That's right. They have a kid.
But it wasn't Gus. It was a fake baby in the stroller. It was clearly fake as they're walking down the Rue de Liberté. But you hear the sound. You hear like,
Nope. That is two child's play Chucky doll for me.
So
no,
Gus
thank
is
you.
Still missing in action. We haven't seen a living Gus.
We'll see when he goes to college.
In like 10 episodes or so. I thought it was funny when they're just walking down the street trying to scheme about how to get rid of Lita. Boy, did Lita do a great job on that attic, though.
It looked great. Skylight, working sink, wide open space.
Let's do the garage next.
Right. And the whole situation with Lita brought up a very interesting question. And I really liked this, is that it's a question of consent. That just because it happened once doesn't mean that it's an all access pass.
I think Lita thought that she had the all access pass to just enter the room, not necessarily... scissor kick. Well,
that's still a thing. That's still a question of consent. Like, why did she feel that she had that pass to walk in when a couple were having an intimate moment?
Yeah, I got some notes on this. So Lindsay finally finds her balls and tells Lita to hit the road instead of Melanie, which Melanie had rehearsed it because Melanie can get rid of anybody that calls on the phone. And I love that it was Lindsay that did it. And I love that she took this gigantic like gulp of wine as Lita starts talking. And then out on the sidewalk, there's this scene between Melanie and Lita that I thought was interesting.
That's a relief. We were worried you...
First, I renovate your attic and then I renovate your sex life. And then it's so long, Lita.
That's not what we meant.
That's how it sounded.
But yeah, why did she think that she was going to stay there forever in a menage a trois? How did she get to that conclusion of...
They had sex once.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand this whole idea that Lita was feeling used in some way.
Right.
Because she offered to do the attics and they initially declined and tried to do it themselves. And in sort of an act
Lindsay
of desperation,
her out of there.
They said, Lita, could you please help us? And in the moment... Their threesome worked and they were attracted to each other at that time and agreed to it at that time. Again, that doesn't mean that Lita then is now part of some sort of throuple. That's not what they wanted to do.
You find a place? Lucky Lita lands on her feet like you give a shit.
As a matter of fact, I do. I feel terrible that...
That you've turned into a proper, dignified, hypocritical bitch?
And I don't quite get that line because what was Melanie doing that was hypocritical?
I did not get it either.
What was she doing that was a bitch or dignified
this turnaround with Lita.
Right.
Just I didn't buy her argument.
It was a very bizarre thing. I like that they were playing to the two main characters, which are Melanie and Lindsay. At the expense of Lita, but at the same time, the story just became very implausible.
It was as if they felt the only way they could get rid of Lita was for them to get angry at each other. And I feel right. like the show does this a lot, that in order to get rid of people, it has to end on bad terms.
Mm-hmm.
It couldn't have been them ending with like a, you finished the attic, clink, thank you. And then they awkwardly try and say, oh, it's a shame to see you go. And she's like, I get it. Like, I want to give Lita more credit than that.
Yeah, because we liked Lita. We liked
I would have thought she would have been like, listen, I get it. I thought it would be nice if maybe we could see where this goes, but that's cool. But I am going to leave. I think it's the best for all of us. I wanted to give Lita that kind of credit.
My disconnect was how she thought that because they had a threesome and she did the attic that she was now part of that. And Lindsay and Melanie really set her straight when she said,
well, Lindsay and I were a couple. And that means there's no room in our life or a bed for a third party, no matter how much we may care for her.
And then Lita, played by the delightful Nancy Sakovich, roars off into the sunset on her motorcycle after 7 episodes.
Vroom.
Gone. Nancy Sakovich was on Psi Factor. She played 87 episodes on that show. It was kind of a sci-fi show. It was pretty big at the time. She sort of stopped acting in 2004, and that's where her IMDb profile ends. I don't know what happened to her.
Hey, some people just leave the business.
So Debbie goes bowling. This is like, I don't know what this
is. Let's just cut through this. Because
I don't know what the story was for.
You know what? And this was a point I wanted to make about the whole episode I felt at first is that I felt like that really not a whole lot happened other than the whole Justin and Ethan and
right.
And
the rest Ryan. Was filler.
It was all very much filler. And I felt it was very much the quiet before the storm.
Get rid of Lita.
Great,
go
check.
Bowling. Have Ted Why? Fall for Emmett.
Sure. All to just set us up for the season finale and get us into season 3. It just felt like it was...
Yeah, they couldn't get out of the season fast enough.
Yeah, especially after, you know, especially after the finale with all of the George Sickle drama now finally behind us.
Yep.
This episode very much felt like, well, we really only need to talk about this. What are we going to do about everybody else? And so they have this bowling...
Cops versus queers.
Yes.
There was something that Debbie said here that I don't know what I thought about this. So she goes up to take her turn on the lane, and there's clearly a queer man next to her bowling.
Mm-hmm.
And Debbie says,
love your balls. Thanks.
Her comment just as easily could have been taken as homophobic by the gay bowlers the same way that they took the cop prancing around. How did the queers know that Debbie was like a teammate?
How do they know that she's a fan?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very good question.
So she throws out what, if you didn't know Debbie, would arguably be like a step up.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. I just thought that was weird, which we know Debbie, so the line makes sense, but the guy that she said it to didn't know Debbie.
Maybe he's a regular at the diner.
Could be, but
this is me trying to find a real stretch in it. And that, I mean, it's not like she's a mother to all of the gays of Pittsburgh.
If he would have responded with, thanks, Debbie.
Totally.
Then it carries it. But instead it's like, oh, thanks.
Oh, thanks.
And then the other cop comes out and prances around. And they were like a thing. So I thought that was a little bit awkward. But Debbie's mouth is what gets her into the cops versus queers bowl off. She says to Horvath, it's like, there's a lot of gay bowlers. It's like, oh?
Name one. I could name several. Yeah. We have our own gay team, the Liberty Balls, which I love. I think that's hilarious. It's all bullshit, but I love that she came up with that on the spot. But it's also great scene to watch those cops. It's like fragile masculinity at its finest. You know, they kept saying like, well, he's not going to get anywhere near my ass. It's like, it takes a lot to be able to take it up the ass. That's all I'm saying.
I thought this scene would have been better if the cops had their guns on their hips. Because
why?
Well, it would have been that good contrast between like the femininity, masculinity. These cops are like tough guy. They're like they got guns and badges on their belt.
So you wanted them to bowl in uniform?
No, undercover.
Oh.
Think Jimmy Smits, an NYPD blue. Mm, those suits that he wore there.
Anyway.
So Horvath is starting to get a little handsy with Debbie. Whoa, he's always going in for the move. Where do you think Debbie's reluctance to snog him is coming from? She just wanted nothing to do with it. And the whole time I was thinking, okay, she hasn't done it in a while, but I don't know. Get in there, girl.
That could be it. It's been a very long time. She's not used to really showing affection like that so outwardly.
Yeah,
not being used to someone
weak.
Finding her attractive the way Horvath does. Like, he's clearly into her.
So the bowling event starts. Cops are squares. Emmett drops the ball and everybody rushes to him like he had just ripped a shoulder out and it landed on the lane. All he did was drop the ball and not even sprain his wrist. He dropped the ball. All of a sudden, like, oh, everybody, oh, quick, Emmett, help him. The only thing missing was somebody get a doctor, like they did when Ben fell down.
Someone get Dr. David Cameron. And yes. So what happens is that this means that they get to do a substitution and tag Ben in. Now,
tag him in.
Ben has been...
Get out there and bowl, Ben.
Yes, because clearly he can still do it. Michael has had a lot of reluctance to having Ben do something strenuous like bowl. But
look,
please, fuck him. I mean, what?
Ben looked slightly less awkward bowling than he did on a bicycle. Remember I made that comment
yes,
about how he looks so
ben
awkward
Ben has
on a
actually
bike.
Really great form for a bowler. I was really impressed.
Well, I thought he was still awkward. His ball delivery was a little off. Or his release moment.
No, it was pretty on point.
I think he had the wrong leg forward. I think when he delivered, he had his left leg forward and he was bowling.
Let's go to the tape. Let's go to the tape and see.
Definitely the right leg. I don't know. I think Robert Gant has always had these like awkward physical moments until he's in the gym weightlifting.
And then his form is just
yeah, spot
fine.
On. Something interesting in this bowl-a-thon is why didn't we ever see Brian bowl? This seemed like a great opportunity to hark back to Brian and his father, Jack Kenny, the bowler.
Oh my God, that's
Brian
so true.
Has his own
that's
ball.
That's so true. No, he bowled it down the street, remember?
Presumably they went and got it, right?
I thought that was supposed to be a very symbolic moment that he was letting Jack go.
Well, he at least kept the bowling shirt. Remember
that's
he
true.
Had the bowling shirt on, so that was a moment for him to wear, but instead he's just in a white V-neck tee.
Some of the costuming work lacked a little, unlike the prop work.
Yeah, I thought this was a great opportunity to have a very subtle callback to that. And didn't even have to make a meal out of it. Just like, hey.
Little wink.
Brian's wearing Jack's bowling shirt. Look at that. It's almost like the discussions that people had on Facebook over why did Justin top Brian? Ooh, there are some like spirited people out there.
It was so great. I'm glad that people were questioning it because I thought it was a very legitimate thing to bring up.
I don't know. I still look at that scene and I'm thinking like, so what?
Okay.
Maybe because I see like topping and bottoming as mutually inclusive.
Yeah. Okay.
Fully verse, you can get both, right?
Yeah. I mean,
it's like,
I think Justin clearly.
It doesn't necessarily mean that you're submissive if you're a bottom.
I thought
I've
it was
some bottoms that
wanted,
are very dominant.
I wanted to bring it up because I thought it was significant that it was the first time we were finally seeing that and that it was a clear decision on Justin's part to say, I want to top you.
I think somebody said on Facebook that this had already happened once, but I couldn't remember where it was.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
I think we would need to know the exact moment so I could go back and
frame by
and
frame.
Capture it. Yeah.
I did like that the queers didn't win in the bowling
yes,
tournament.
Yes, it was very, very close.
Because the queers always win in this show. If not...
Because it's their show.
Well, if not temporarily, the win eventually comes
yes.
their way. And a lot of things are just like super easy for the story. And so I'm glad that they didn't win. I was totally expecting Ben to bowl the strike and to win.
But nine pins.
Yeah. So I like that. That was a nice touch. Good writing.
And Horvath joins the losing group.
Do you think it's weird that Debbie still calls Carl Horvath? Forabath?
No, Forabath. I think it's fine that she calls Forabath because it almost becomes like a pet name. Like, I feel like couples, when they're starting out, they find something that's kind of unique
yeah.
within them and it sticks with them. And I think that's what's going on here. And, you know, he goes to congratulate them because clearly it was a very close game. It wasn't the sweep that the cops
right.
thought it was going to be. And then, wow, that makeout.
Yeah, but they didn't even seem to have tongue. That looked like a closed mouth kiss to me.
It was still passionate, and it was exciting for Debbie. So good for her.
Yeah, she got some.
She got hers.
I thought it was nice that Carl went out of his way to go to the gay bar to make out with her.
I'm starting to like him more and more.
Yeah, that was a nice touch.
Yeah.
So let's tie up this episode here. Timeliness. I gave this one, this might surprise you, a 4. Because everything except the gay bowling tournament still goes on. So I did find it timely, if not in the news. I think the theme of Justin, Ethan, Brian, Michael is very timely. So I gave it a 4. Marked it up from my normal 3, like, yes, this show is not showing me anything new that really matters today.
It might surprise you, Patrick, to know that I also gave it a 4 because of what happens when people have that open relationship and they have these rules. What happens when that following those rules then becomes into question? Are they going beyond that? Are they starting to bend the rules in some way? And I think with Justin and Ethan, it is a bending of the rules in that they have clearly made out. They have clearly been together more than once. It's almost as if sometimes you can start to question whether or not Justin's going to come home at the end of the night. So yeah, that's why I give it a 4. And I think that's something that always plays into today's relationships as more and more people are experimenting with that or agreeing to that, and how couples have to try and navigate the sort of way relationships play out now.
Information accuracy, I gave this one a 3. There's just nothing out of whack with this one.
Yep. Same here. Nothing offensive. There wasn't really anything for us to reach out to.
Yeah, this episode didn't have any lessons, which is probably why we're really laughing at it a lot more than usual.
Right. It's just very quiet.
Yeah, some of the other episodes, they seem like they're trying to teach us a moral or a gay history lesson or something like that. This was a fun episode, and there was just nothing all that out of whack with it. So, relatability. I gave this one a 5.
Whoa.
The bowling story was throwaway. It served really only as a vehicle for Debbie to get closer to have a bath. For a bath?
For a bath.
For a bath. Carl Horvath. But the square between Justin, Ethan, Brian, and Michael is very relatable. And I think it's something that an awful lot of gay guys experience at some point, where everybody becomes sort of interchangeable in their close circle of friends. And the lines start getting blurred between, do I tell him? Don't I tell him? Who are my loyalties to? So this story was told well, and it didn't make me cringe. So 5.
I gave it a 3.
Oof.
And that's not a bad thing. It's just...
it's average.
It's average. I guess there wasn't anything exceptional to it. While I found it more timely, the relatability on my end was a little less so.
And the one scene that I really loved here, though, was the Ted scene. Ted when he's pretending to be Brian and then seeing
that
the
was
reality.
Just brilliant.
That was great.
That was where I totally bought into the humor that this episode was trying to bring to. So I really appreciated that.
Yeah. So that's our verdict on the penultimate episode of season 2, Bowling for Equality.
Next week, Justin must decide who he should be with, Brian or Ethan.
Ben tells Michael he is going away for 6 months.
Ted reveals his true feelings to Emmett.
That will be season finale of season 2. And it's called Out with a Whimper. We are still Queer as Folk. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us, and subscribe. It really does mean a lot to us and helps more people find our show.
We're on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF, and you can like us on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
And if you want to connect with us personally, and I really hope you do, you can find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall with no E's.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Matthew PD.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez.
New episodes every Wednesday as we take apart the show one episode at a time.
Available now on iTunes,
Google Play,
Stitcher,
TuneIn,
Overcast,
Pocket Cast, and all your other favorite podcatchers.
Still, Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.